You know what was on the jukebox in the front. Now Matt the Cat's gonna show you what was on the juke in the back.
Hey there, Hep Cats and Crazy Kittens. I'm your jukebox operator, Matt the Cat. Where it's at? Hitting the racks and stacks from the fronts to the backs, boiling that hot wax as I spin the shellacks. Welcome to the soul that came before rock and roll, 1940s and 50s rhythm and blues, the juke in the back. And this week we're going to celebrate a true rhythm and blues legend. The last of the honkin' sax players has left us at the age of 91. I'm talking about Cecil Big J. McNeely, who burst on the scene in the late 1940s with his screaming tenor saxophone and just couldn't be stopped. He was born Cecil McNeely in the Watts section of Los Angeles on April 29, 1927. He was heavily influenced by the saxes of Jack McVeigh in Illinois Jacket. But Savoy label owner Herman Lubinsky didn't think Cecil had a ring to it, so he renamed him Big J. McNeely. I was fortunate enough to interview Big J. McNeely several years ago, and I'll be playing that interview back during this week's program. We'll kick that off in just a few minutes, but first, let's introduce the late, great Big J. McNeely with a fantabulous number from 1949. Spinning off Savoy, hold on to your hats. It's Big J. McNeely and his Blue Jays with Wild Wig. It's wild, it's crazy, it's out of control. A big number 12 record from 1949, the biggest year of Big J's career, Wild Wig off Savoy Records. And you know, Big J was discovered by Johnny Otis one night while he was playing at Otis's Barrel House Club in the Watts section of Los Angeles. Otis took him to Herman Lubinsky at Savoy because Otis was currently signed to Savoy Records then. Lubinsky started putting his records out, and the rest is history. We unfortunately lost Big J on September 16th, 2018, at the age of 91. But I was very fortunate to have a couple of interviews with Big J over the years. So let's hear Big J tell his story in his own words. Please help me welcome the great Big J McNeely.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing there, big guy?
Oh, fine.
Now, when you were growing up, what type of music? Were you listening to jazz?
Yeah, you know, I started off playing jazz. Sonny Chris and I in Hampton Halls, we had a little jazz band. That's when Charlie Parker came to Billy Burke's in Hollywood. They had Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Howard McGee, Teddy Edwards, Lucky Thompson, you know, and Ward L. Gray, and all those guys, you know, North Jackets, you know, all them guys was in Los Angeles. And so we grew up, I grew up playing jazz. But then after a while, I got out of school, I wouldn't study, and then I had my first hit record as a soul, and from then on I was branded as a soul man.
Yeah. Now, whenever I listen to your frantic records like 3D or Nervous Man Nervous, it's like you're blowing a bebop sax.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I said. I was very influenced by playing jazz, and I had a chance to study from a good teacher who played first chair at RKO Studio, and he taught that full vibrato at 100 with a big sound, you know. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, a lot of the guys used to say, yeah, he's playing one note, but they never criticized the sound or, you know, playing one note. You can play one note, but it's how you play the one note, you know, that create excitement, you know.
Exactly. And, of course, you put the showmanship into
it
as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was part of my thing, you know.
Well, that's one of the things that separates you from a lot of the guys of the time.
Yeah.
Is you were the whole package, the sound and the showman.
Yeah, it was really great. I remember, and now I have a wireless, you know, but at that time I got put in jail, arrested in San Diego. I didn't have a wireless, you know, and so the outside, and the band couldn't hear me, you know. My brother and the other guy couldn't get out because it was so crowded, and the police off-duty came by and called the station. They came put me in jail because I was blowing my horn out of the street, you know. So the band was still playing. They said, well, man, where's this guy at? You know? And my brother came down and bailed me out.
I heard that story, but I want to know if this is true. So you get put in jail for playing the horn outside while the band is still playing inside.
Yeah, well, see, we was downtown San Diego, you know, and all the buildings were closed. So I guess this guy off-duty thought, who's this crazy guy playing his horn out in the street, you know, this time of night, you know? And he don't know what's going on, so he called, and it was a kid there from the Navy. They said, hey, man, this guy's working, man. In fact, the police told him in jail, too. They said, well, man, we got this call, so we got to take him down. So I went to the court the next day, because I had to go out of town, you know, so I pleaded not guilty, because I wanted to try to explain. The guy said, okay, you have to go to the court in the afternoon. So I pleaded guilty, and the guy said $50 fine, and he suspended, said, but don't go out in the street no more, you know.
Yeah. But the way I heard the story is that the band kept playing until you got bailed out and could come back. Is that true? That's not true, right?
Well, the band kept on playing, and my brother had to go down and get me out of jail. So Hunter Hancock, you know.
Old H.H.
Yeah, H.H. So he was an MC, and so they wanted to come down to the jailhouse. And the guy said, no, man, don't go down there, man. They'll probably never let him out.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so you grew up in Watts.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Watts.
And you were playing the clubs around Los Angeles.
Yeah, I played all the clubs. Back when I was 16, that's when I started playing my horn, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, man, it has to be a better way to make a living than working 8 hours. So I picked up my brother's horn and started playing. And then, like when I was in high school, around 18, you know, I could play on the bandstand, but when intermission came, I had to walk outside, you know.
Because you were too young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I played all the players. I played with Johnny Owens at the Bell House. It was a jam there with him. Mm-hmm. And then, Sonny Chris and I, we had a band. We played The Last Word. That's when Central Avenue was the thing. You know, they had the Club Alabama was across the street, just like the Cotton Club in New York. And they had the Downbeat and The Last Word. And you had, after hours, everybody would go, like, to the basket rooms and play. And the Scatman Carrettas and Slim Gaylord and all the guys would be there after hours jamming. So we played all down First Street. You know, but anyway, we was young then because we had to change nights, graduation to get off the, so because we still working at the club at that time.
Playing the LA clubs, how did you come to the attention of Herman Lubinsky at Savoy Records?
It's a funny thing. It was a guy named Prince Danzel. I was knowing. He said, "Man, Big Day, you want to record?" I said, "Yeah, you know." And so he happened to know this guy. So a little guy had a little record shop in Watts called Pete Kennard. He would go out and select his records because he didn't want to get stuck with records. He had a little record shop, and he gave me a record with Ben Miller. With the drums, you know, with the introduction. Mm-hmm. And so I take it home, and I wrote the tune, Deacon's Hop. Mm-hmm. So we went in the studio, and Lubinsky came out, and came out to my house in a cab, and sat down, and he asked me, what was my name? I said, Cecil. He said, no, what's your nickname? I said, Jay. He said, Big Jay. In fact, he's the one who gave me the name. At that time, I was still small, wasn't a big, you know.
So, you had to grow into your name, right?
Yeah, so we went in the studio, and he just said, yeah, keep blowing, man. So I just got this, man, for about a year and a half studying, very legit, you know, studying solfège, ear training, and all that stuff. But I just said, I forgot everything. I said, I'm just going to play soul, man.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big hit for me. And I would have went on the road then, but bought an ally with Johnny Otis. He was saying, man, how these guys get you back there and get you signed all these contracts, steal all your money and everything. So, then I wanted my brother to go with me, but he said, no, you can't come. So I wouldn't go. My record was number one in the country. I didn't go.
So Johnny Otis kind of took you under his wing and kind of told you to watch out for these guys.
Well, Johnny Otis, plus Broadway Ally, that's the one that discovered Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. He was like with Johnny Otis' manager. So he knew what was happening because he was from back east, so he knew how those guys operated. So it was good because, you know, you go out on the road, you get through bad, you come back, you owe everybody money, and you don't have any money. You got everybody on payroll. They charge you more money for your suits, your clothes, and the others. the best, man.
Right. Well, let's hear the record that established you, 1948 on Savoy Records, Deacon's Hop.
Okay.
Support for this week's Juke in the Back provided by Janice Stenhouse, Robert Stallworth, Barry from San Diego, Thomas Huber, Alfonso Capozzi, and the Stepping Stone Inn in Salem, Massachusetts. Thank you for your support. More information at jukeintheback.org.
These are the real roots of rock and roll. You couldn't hear them on the jukebox in the front. But Matt the Cat's playing him on the Juke in the Bag.
Thank you.
Big J McNeely, this week's feature here on the Juke in the Back, 1940s and 50s Rhythm and Blues. From 1952, spinning off the Federal label, which was a subsidiary of King Records out of Cincinnati, that's The Goof. And on that record, man, you can really hear Big J blowing on tenor saxophone, backed up by his brother Bob, who he's trading lines with on baritone sax. Now back to our interview with legendary sax honker Big J McNeely.
Now, you were you mentioned before about Jesse Belvin. I wanted to talk to you about when you assembled your vocal group, Three Dots and a Dash.
Yes.
How that came about? You just figure you wanted to branch out a little bit and get into the vocal songs a little?
Yeah, well, Jesse and I were very, very good friends. You know, I was the first one to carry him on the road. His mother, you know, let him go with me, you know. And we went on the road. We was down there in Atlanta, Georgia. I can tell you some stories about Georgia.
Oh, I bet. You run into trouble in Georgia, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Guy, I'll never get to Savannah, Georgia. But anyway, you know, I knew Jesse. We grew up real great. He's a great guy. He'd give you coat off his back. I mean, he's a lovely guy. And so we just, a little kid named Jimmy Huff that was in there wrote this tune called All That Wine Gone. See, when I used to have all these shows out here, I had Spanish. I had like one white kid sang like Frankie Lane. I had a saxophone, Spanish kid, saxophone player from Santiana. In fact, he's a cartoonist for Walt Disney in Florida now.
Oh, wow.
And so I had a lot of Spanish. I had a very mixed band, so that was to draw everybody. See, we used to go around and play all the high schools and everything. Then when they get do the session on the weekend, it would just be packed, you know. So what happened, they got to the point where the police started barring me out because they never, they couldn't understand why the kid was responding to the music because they never seen that before. Because, you know, at that time you had Frank Sinatra and Perry Como and all those guys, you know. And Hunter was the only station that was playing what they call race music at that time. That's why he was so big, you know, because you want to hear that type of music, you had to turn into to Hunter. And like we played out in Huntington Beach, and one guy wrote an article and said they had like 1,000 kids dancing like Watusis. <You know? laughs> So they couldn't stop it. So what they did, they wouldn't give me a permit to play because we did a thing at the Shrine Auditorium with Earl Bostic.
Yeah.
And Gene Norman had to get a special permit, man, for me to play, you know.
So they pulled your permit to get you to stop playing because you were mixing the races.
Yeah, that's it. They didn't understand. They'd come around shooting pictures. They thought they was high on drugs or something. You know, they didn't know because all the kids were responding. And they said, what is this, you know, because they'd never seen it before, you know. So they're shooting pictures and stuff, and police is coming. So they say, well, the only way we can do it, just stop the guy. But we won't give him no permit to play.
Well, when was that, early 50s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So at that time, when you were when your permit was pulled, is that about the time when Three Dots and a Dash got together?
Yeah.
When you hired Jesse to sing with you?
Yeah, I went with Imperial. See, first I thought it was Savoy, and then I went with Imperial.
Right.
To Imperial, and then I went to Lou Chud over to Imperial Records.
Yeah.
My booking agent knew him, and so that's when I started trying to branch out. And I do something different, you know, with All That Wine Is Gone. And
so let's hear that record, All That Wine Is Gone, Jesse Belvin's first appearance on Wax, singing with your vocal group, Three Dots and a Dash.
All that wine is gone. Bon Jerry, Elderberry, my ideal, the big bear, wild baby.
Talking before, I just want to touch on this one more time. You talking before about how they pulled your permit because you were mixing the races. They didn't know why the white kids and the Hispanic kids were going crazy.
Yeah.
And now, as time progressed, as the 50s progressed, do you remember when your type of music, when race music, when R&B music became rock and roll and became the mainstream, things probably loosened up a little bit for you, didn't they?
Well, not necessarily. So the only thing that helped me out was with a powerful agency, and that was GHC. They booked Nat King Cole and all Sammy Davis and all the heavy cats, you know. And so when you work with a big agency, they'd get on the phone and call, hey, I want you got the guy. And they have to take you because they want the other acts. So that's why I was a privilege to work Birdland in New York. We'll say like all the children group, Charles Brown, all the guys, they would work the Apollo. And, you know, they wanted to hang out in New York, but there was nowhere for them to work in New York, no little club. So, but I was working, I'd work the Apollo, and I'd go to Birdland. I was working Bandbox, worked Bandbox with Cab Calloway, worked Birdland with Diz, Sarah, all the big acts. Right. And because I'm with GAC, and that's why I was able to move.
So they were putting you in the clubs to hit an older demographic. You weren't playing to the kids at those clubs in Birdland.
No. Those clubs were, you know, the older people. And once I performed, and then I had no problem. I was working Wildwood, New Jersey, working Philadelphia, and I worked the whole Apollo Theater. Like, it all depends what kind of manager you got. Man, I'm headlining the show, and here's the five girls that don't do it, top number of the country, but I'm headlining the show and the Apollo, you know. But so it all who your agent is that, you know, the recognition or position that you get.
So even in the late 1950s, after rock and roll had, you know, settled down, had you know, Little Richard was going strong, Fats Domino was going strong, Elvis was going strong, even at that time, it was still not accepted for you to play to the screaming kids. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, at that time, it kind of, like you say, it did ease up a little bit, but what they did, they taken the saxophone out and put the guitar in it, and it changed from rhythm and blues to rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And so when they changed the title of it, the same type of stuff, changed the title of it, then that's when Dick Clark came in. You know, for a long time, Dick Clark
cleaned it up.
Yeah, Dick Clark never had a black artist on the show for a long time. You know?
He bleached it.
Yeah, so, and then, even back east, with this other guy that, what's his name out of Cleveland, I think. I can't think of his name now.
Alan Freed?
Yeah, because I did his show there in Cleveland.
I was just going to ask you about Freed, because the thing is, Freed loved the honking saxophones.
Yeah, I know. That's what I did. I did a show with him, because I worked Cleveland. Like I said, I worked Cleveland, Pittsburgh, you know, all through it. Like I say, being with GAC, I worked that whole circuit, you know, and I worked for Alan Freed when he first started. So a lot of people think all this stuff happened back east, but it happened on the West Coast, you know, like Little Esther and Johnny Lewis had his big shows with all his people, you know. And so all this really happened on the West Coast.
Did you play any of the packaged Freed shows?
I did one, but not travel. I played on one in Cleveland, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And then that went, like, you know, at that time they had what they call a top 10. They would start in New York. They would start in New Orleans. And that's when we had to do two concerts, you know, one for the white, one for the black.
Oh, man.
It was tough then. And so that was a top 10 review. And I was supposed to back the band. I happened to know this guy from Gale Agency. And I saw him in New York. And he said, you want to do the tour? I said, yeah. So I was supposed to back all the acts and then do my performance. But when we got ready to do the show, Joe Turner wanted Chuck Camel, because the band had backed him. So he said, and they flew in about seven musicians to make a big band, you know. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, man, this guy can't play my music. And I said, okay, so let Chuck Camel. I took up my same money. So I want to do maybe about...
Oh, you're telling me Big Joe turned you down?
Well, what happened is Joe Turner wanted Chuck Camel, a band that traveled with him.
Yeah.
So he tried to act like, oh, we couldn't play his music.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, right.
You know, so he was trying to pull strings to get in.
Uh-huh.
So So the guy said, okay, man, you know, I'll just pay you the same money. You just do your little act. And so, like, they had two buses.
Yeah.
And they put all the big acts on the nice bus, and they put the band on the little raggedy bus, you know. But the guy had told me about this because I was playing behind Faye Adams doing some gigs.
Oh,
guy,
love and, Faye Adams. Love
yeah,
Faye.
So the guy would tell me how they treat the band, you know. So they said, well, okay, man, you can ride in the nice bus, but I'm going to put your band. I said, oh, no, man. So we just taken our own car and drove. And we got to the place we had to sleep in our station wagon sometime because they had all the rooms, you know. Can you imagine
yeah.
that big show, like you had the Five Keys, the Moon Glows, Still Satin, the Satins, the Robins, Etta James, Joe Turner, Little Richard, Bill Dog, all these people on the show, packed, you know what I mean? So, you know, and when you got down there, man, you had to go to in the black neighborhood, man, to get a room.
Hotel,
so, I mean,
yeah.
how many rooms did they have?
And so the hotels are booked, and after you play one of these killer shows, you end up sleeping in your car because all the rooms in
gone.
The black part of town are booked.
Yeah, gone, man.
That's crazy. Tell us.
In fact, you couldn't even eat, man, you know, because you know you had to go to the back, you know. So we knew it. We got off one night, drove up to one of them driving. So we drove to the back, man, said, we don't even want your money. So we just had to keep on going, you know. Huh. Oh, it was tough during that time, down there, man.
I have heard some horror stories about touring the South back
in
the 50s.
Oh, tough, man, tough.
Now it's time for the Great 78, where we take a thick piece of shellac and harken back to a time when 78 RPM records were king. And this week we're featuring the great sax honker Big J McNeely. Earlier in the program, we heard one of his vocal records with his vocal group Three Dots and a Dash. They recorded several sides for the Imperial label in 1951. This one was cut in January of 1951 in Hollywood. And it features Jesse Belvin and Mercy D on vocal. Here's Big J McNeely with Three Dots and a Dash, and this week's Great 78. Here's Insect Ball.
Lawrence Harper is by the Insect Hall. The insect is happy, the insect ball. The music is punished by a cricket bat, and all the insects
fight. He couldn't go, he had to work that night. The flea rode up on a fine bull buck. Should've heard the band when he struck up.
Grasshopper hopped in, she looked about. She didn't say a word, she just hopped back out.
While all the insects were filled with glee, the ant did the boogie with the bee.
There was a head bug, red bug, scared bug, dead bug.
Wrong bug, right bug, white bug, light bug.
Skinny bugs, fat bugs, thinny bugs, flat bugs, fly, flea, gnats, bees, and ants in the BVD.
Hermit got high and bit a groove in the floor. When they kicked him out, he had a hole in the door.
All good things must come to an end. The gnat opened the bottle that he thought was gin. He stepped to the bar for a drinking spree. What do you know? It was DDT.
Listening to The Juke in the Back with Matt the Cat.
Thank you. Roger.
Roger.
Drop torpedo, blimp.
Dig that cat. He's
nervous.
On the phone with me right now from LA. Now, Big J, that was a cool song. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, it was really great. A lot of kids, when I'm traveling in Europe, they love the Nervous Man, Nervous, you know.
Now, in the late 1950s, 1959, you scored what was your biggest pop success. I mean, Deacon's Hop was a huge rhythm and blues tune, but There's Something on Your Mind was your biggest pop success.
Yeah, it was a big tune for me. It's a funny thing when we recorded this thing. We recorded in the guy's basement up in Seattle, Washington. And we didn't have any money to get out. You know, we were scuffing musicians then. So I came back a year later. I knew I had a hit because every place we play it, man, people just love it. They didn't know the title of that song. It just crossed your mind, whatever it was. You know?
Yeah, right.
They wanted to hear the tune. So we got off from work one night, a little sunny, and we all went in the studio. And this guy would record all the bands that would come through Seattle, Washington. So I went back and I got the tape. I brought it to Hollywood. I let Hal Singer, you know, he was the guy that booked a lot of things. I've taken it down to all the companies, you know, and they said, oh, no, we don't want that, it's nothing. So Holland Hancock was open, getting ready to open a record company with Devonport. So what he would do is make a tape of it and put it on the air. If he got any response, then he would put it out. You know, he wasn't going to invest the money, you know. And so, because he liked me, he said, okay, I'll go ahead and print it up. So he said, Big J, this not going to be nothing. But he said, for you, I'll put it out. I said, okay. So I know I had a hit record. So we was back in Bobby Darin and Chuck Berry. We was getting I was only getting $150 a night, man. I had to have a 60s band, man. And we had to pay traveling. And we had to pay traveling tax, you know, 10% traveling tax. So I knew I had a record. So we got to San Francisco. A guy named Rockin' Lucky came on at 12 o'clock at night. And I put that record on, man. There is something. Man, this town went crazy, man. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one had the record, you know. So, 'cause, you know, like, usually you send your you put your records into the distributors and try to get them into the store. You know, you go go that way. But I went the other way. I put it on the air. And so everybody was calling the stations trying to find it, trying to go to the record company, couldn't
That's
find
great.
It, calling the distributor. Nobody had a record, but the record was tearing the town. Everybody went. So hey, the only way they could hear it, they'd have to hear it on their show. So the next day I called Hunter. I said, man, you got to get some records up here, man, because this thing is taking off.
What I love about that record is that is you got Little Sonny, who sounds just great on that. Just really fits the record great. But the other thing is, you got Wild Big J McNeely, you know, kind of hanging back a little bit. Like you when you play 3D, Nervous Man, Nervous, you know, all those crazy records where you're just, you know, blowing as fast as you can. And then you really hung back and just blew a real mournful sax.
Yeah, well, like when the kid first had when I heard the tune, the guy who wrote it, he like Fats Domino, you know, and I said, no, man, you have to cut this thing in half, man, you know. So we just cut everything in half and just laid it in there. And Little Sonny loved Ray Charles, and he swear if you turn your back, you swear it was Ray Charles, man, because he came out of the gospel down south. He had a lot of soul, man. And so I said, no, man, you sang it exactly the way it is on this tape. And that's what he did, and it turned out to be a big hit.
It was a big hit, and that's I'm going to close our time together with There's Something on Your Mind with Little Sonny singing. And I hope to have you back on the show real soon, Big J.
Man, I sure appreciate this interview, man.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, man.
There is something on your mind by the way you look at me. There is something on your mind, honey, by the way you look at me. Can what you're thinking bring happiness, or will it bring misery? No, no, please don't try to tell me. I think I understand. No, no, you don't have to tell me, pretty baby. I think I understand. You want me to try and forget you, but I'll do the best I can. Do-do-do-do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do-do-do-do.
This week's guest, Big J McNeely, with the biggest hit of his career, 1959's There's Something on Your Mind, featuring Little Sonny Werner on lead vocal. That record crossed over and hit number 44 on the pop charts and number 5 on the rhythm and blues lists. It was released on Hunter Hancock's Swingin' label. From there, McNeely continued to perform throughout the 1960s and made a couple of worthy albums for Warner Brothers Records before quitting the music business and joining the post office in the early 70s. By the early 80s, the big rhythm and blues revivals were happening in Europe, and Jay was right there, baby. He became a major draw at the annual European festivals. He even got back into the business of recording and released his last album in 2016. Big J McNeely succumbed to cancer on September 16th, 2018. I hope you enjoyed this week's show and a look back at the fantabulous career of Big J McNeely. Always remember that soul, it's not a black thing, it's not a white thing, it's a feeling. And you'll get that feeling each week when you tune into your source for 1940s and 50s rhythm and blues, The Juke in the Back. Gonna leave you with a record that Big J McNeely cut with the great Johnny Otis Orchestra back in 1949. It was originally released on the Regent label. It's a swinging instrumental called Headhunter. I'm Matt the Cat, and I'll catch y'all on the flip side. Goodbye, everybody.
Well, we've run out of whiskey, and the women have all gone home. Thanks for dropping by. Feel free to let Matt the Cat know if you dug the show. Email him at mattthecat@mattthecat.com. Juke in the Back is recorded at Rosie's Juke Joint, located at the Stepping Stone Inn in Salem, Massachusetts. For more information, please visit jukeintheback.org. I'm Miss Rosie. See you next time on the Juke in the Back.